Also, I'll be speaking today at 4 o'clock at the University of Michigan's 50th anniversary of the first Vietnam War teach-in. It's at 4 o'clock at Angel Hall on State Street in Ann Arbor. You can go visit our website at democracynow.org for details. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
If you are interested in country western music, tune in Saturday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. for Swingin' Country on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. That's Swingin' Country, 6 to 9 a.m. every Saturday morning.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Leaked documents show... Oh, coming up on the KBOO Evening News, leaked documents show that the Transportation Security Administration frequently engages in profiling of airline passengers.
Senator Ron Wyden changes the location of a fundraiser to avoid dealing with fair trade protesters.
And Saudi Arabia continues airstrikes on Yemen with U.S. support.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 27th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. A Vancouver, Washington SWAT team has been surrounding a home in the city since around 1 o'clock this afternoon. The siege began after Vancouver Fire Department personnel responded to a call of a fire in a yard on Esther Street. When fire personnel arrived, the male resident went inside the home and pointed what appeared to be a long gun out of the window. No shots were fired and there were no injuries. Vancouver police as well as SWAT personnel are on the scene attempting to get the suspect to surrender. Multiple homes around the residence have been evacuated and multiple schools were in lockdown until they sent students home for the day. No additional information is available at this time. This is the third incident in the last 2 weeks in the Oregon-Washington area in which a visit by emergency personnel or police has sparked a standoff. In the Dalles last week, the delivery of a warrant by local police led to a person barricading themselves inside their home and committing suicide. And in Forest Grove this week, a man shot himself after he was served with a restraining order. It's unknown whether police and other emergency personnel tried to include mental health professionals to intervene in these cases.
Leaked guidelines revealing the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA's protocol for how to detect a terror threat, include watching for behaviors critics claim is akin to profiling. Known as the Screening Passengers by Observation Techniques, or SPOT program, agents use a checklist that runs more than 90 items long. It includes a scoring system whereby people lose points for exhibiting certain behaviors, such as excessive yawning or being clean-shaven. The program's been in use since 2007 and been the source of some controversy. It's drawn scrutiny from both the General Accountability Office and the Office of the Inspector General in 2013 for failing to evaluate the effectiveness of the program. The American Civil Liberties Union took legal action earlier this month after Freedom of Information requests forwarded late last year got no response. The TSA is an organization reporting to the Department of Homeland Security and operating on an annual budget of about $7 billion a year. A single TSA agent was convicted of stealing items valued at more than $800,000 in January, and a report from 2012 revealed that more than 400 TSA officers were fired for theft.
The Portland City Council held a public hearing this week on a proposal that will remove a requirement that people applying for city jobs need to answer a question on whether they have ever been arrested or convicted of a crime. The Ban the Box campaign is trying to make it easier for people who have been convicted of a crime and serve their time to get back into society in order to live productive lives. Here's some of the testimony from this week's hearing.
My name is Stephen Boyd, president of the Ernie Restaurant and Lodging Association. Where we have a problem is saying that that business can't question the applicant during the normal flow of an interview when you're going through resumes, when you're going through job history. That seems to be in certain job areas a question you want to ask and not have to go all the way through the process, do a conditional offer, and then ask the question, do we have a criminal history that doesn't work? And let me give you a couple examples. On the lodging side, because I got calls from some of our lodging members, when you've got people working in the rooms and they've got a pass key to every room in the hotel and they've got access to those rooms when the customer is gone with their personal belongings there, they don't want to have people that have history of theft, burglary, those kinds of things in the room. If it's so in the interview process, if that's the job you're getting interviewed for, that's when that question would be asked. If you're going to be working in catering or if you're going to be working as a doorman, that question's not going to be asked and the demand won't be there. Same with restaurants, handling credit cards, those kinds of issues.
My name is Christine Harbacek, and I support Ban the Box because it gives a hiring system a throwaway issue in regards that when they see the box, they don't want to hire a person. I have spent 18 years in prison, and I've had my trouble in coming out and looking for work. And in the process of looking for work, I have been told that my credentials and my ableness to do the job was acceptable. My resume passed. Yet, because of the box issue and the reason why I was wrongfully convicted, which is related to a sexual offense, kept me from getting employment, kept me from being hired. As long as we have a stigma about these cases that come before hiring people, you will not have productive people coming back into society that want to work, and you won't get people to pay taxes, and you're going to be losing money by sending them back into prison instead of just using the past and using it in the presence and tying the two together as if they're the one and the same person. And they may not even be that person at all to begin with, but the law assessed them, judgment, preconceived them into somebody and sent them away. And the time frame that was spent in prison does not only take away from the individual of who they are or not, but also the time frame is lacking as far as educational inside prison and how to come out of prison into a world that is foreign. And cell phones is all foreign to me. And it's a totally different world you walk into. And they expect within a matter of X amount of time frame to be employed. And that can't be done with the box still on the application. The application boxes you in, confines you, and doesn't help you move forward. It deters the whole effect of what I'm sure you guys aren't here today to have is people going back into prison, and you guys have a tax money going into an area that it is $35, $40 a year, to keep one inside. That money could be better off in us coming out, paying taxes, and supporting back the city And I just thank you for listening.
The city of Portland pushed back a vote on the ordinance to ban the box requiring job applicants to disclose their criminal history. The vote will likely take place sometime in April.
Later this summer, California will update stormwater permit requirements to incorporate the 2008 NERDL law, the first of its kind in the U.S. NERDLs, also known as microbeads, are the raw material in plastics manufacturing. The beads range in size from 1 millimeter to 1/100 of a millimeter in diameter. Consequently, they're small enough to pass through sewage treatment plants and escape into the environment. These microbeads concentrate other environmental pollutants and are small enough to be ingested by wildlife and humans. California is taking the lead in attempting to regulate this relatively new form of pollution. The law specifically regulates pre-production plastics. The state of California currently sends out notifications to microbead polluters to alert them to the upcoming changes in the law.
Animal rights groups are praising a former SeaWorld employee who went on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart this week and criticized the practice of keeping orcas in captivity. John Hargrove, who spent 14 years as an orca trainer, mostly at SeaWorld, has become known as a whistleblower for speaking out about SeaWorld's practices. He condemns these practices as cruel for the animals and dangerous for the trainers. Hargrove went on The Daily Show yesterday to discuss his book and SeaWorld's inhumane practice with Jon Stewart. Here's a clip.
In your career, so you're training whales, at what point do you think to yourself, oh, this is a sentient creature, mm-hmm. and what I'm doing isn't right?
You know, that's a great question, because in the beginning, you don't know what's normal from abnormal or healthy from unhealthy. So mm-hmm. when you get into it in the beginning, you think, are all the dorsal fins like that collapsed in the wild? Are there all their teeth right. worn down like that in the wild? You just don't know. But then once you realize that these are the damaging effects from captivity, and they're dying prematurely, they're dying from illnesses and diseases they're not dying from in the wild.
Right.
And you see all these things, and then the mother-calf separations and how traumatic that is for those animals, even years later. You just get it at some point, morally and ethically, this is just not right. And you know, and what the problem is at that point, you're stuck, because you love those whales so much, mm-hmm. and this was your childhood dream. You feel like, okay, you rationalize it away, almost like a bad relationship.
Sure. Is it possible to have this type of thing in a humane way, or are we kidding ourselves? Are we kidding ourselves that in any way you can keep these large, very smart mammals and even treating them more humanely with less chemicals and more room? Is it even possible to do?
It's not, and I wish that I could tell you that it was, mm-hmm. it would make my job and the way that I reflect back on my life and my career with those animals, make me sleep easier at night. But we tried with the best resources that we had, mm-hmm. and it is clear to see we have an overwhelming amount of science that proves that these animals are not only not thriving, they're not even surviving.
Right.
And the damage, the psychological damage and the physical damage is apparent. You don't have to be an experienced killer whale trainer like I am. You can go to the park and you can look at those whales, look at their teeth, look at the collapsed dorsal fins, look at the death rates of the whales and the ages that they died,
right.
and know that this is just morally and ethically messed up.
That was John Hargrove, a former orca whale trainer at SeaWorld, speaking on The Daily Show last night. His appearance sparked a flurry of conversation on social media about animal cruelty. Supporters of animal rights, including the original trainer of the dolphin Flipper, have joined Hargrove in his critique of holding whales and dolphins in captivity.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis from Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a 20% chance of rain and a high of 63. Sunday, partly cloudy with no chance of rain and a high of 68. Today in history, on March 27, 1962, Archbishop Joseph Francis Rummel of Louisiana called for all Roman Catholic schools in the city of New Orleans to end their segregation policies. The quote of the day is from author Maya Angelou. "We all should know that diversity makes for a rich tapestry, and we must understand that all the threads of the tapestry are equal in value no matter what their color."
A group of 10 former secretaries from the U.S. Department of Commerce published an open letter Wednesday urging Congress to support the president's efforts to secure promotional trade authority. Let me re-say that. Efforts to secure promotional trade authority, I think that's a euphemism for fast track, for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Adam Weissman from the organization Trade Justice spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the letter.
Can you share with us your reaction to the claims they made?
Yeah, well, President Obama is making a hard push right now to try to sell Democrats and really sell the country in general on this failed free trade model that is supposed to create jobs and economic opportunities and prosperity for our country, but time and again has been proven to do just the opposite. The ones who prosper from these trade agreements time and again are wealthy corporations at the expense of U.S. workers, at the expense of the safety of our food, at the expense of our environment. So really this is more of the same kind of pro-corporate spin coming from officials who were directly involved in selling out U.S. workers and shipping our jobs overseas. So they're saying the same things that we would expect them to be saying. These were some of the people that helped to sell us and sell the world on agreements like NAFTA, which have been devastating to the U.S., which was responsible for the loss of over a million U.S. jobs. The U.S.-South Korea trade agreement has been in effect now for only 3 years, but has ballooned our trade deficit with South Korea to 84%, to $12.7 billion, costing 85,000 U.S. jobs. So we know what these trade agreements do, and we should not be fooled by this latest propaganda, and this very disingenuous propaganda. One of the things that they're really pushing in these statements, this one statement from from Commerce Secretary going back to the Nixon administration, and another from from William Daley, the Commerce Secretary from 97 to 2000, is that we need to grant President Obama fast-track authority, so-called trade promotion authority, which in effect turns Congress into a rubber stamp for executive negotiated trade agreements. Congress will delegate power to the executive branch to negotiate trade agreements where the executive branch can then negotiate trade agreements with really no input from Congress. Congress can put guidelines in place as to what they want negotiated and who they want negotiations with, but the president has no obligation to actually pay attention to those things. And then after a negotiation is completed, that negotiated agreement will go to Congress, and then Congress is obligated to vote on that agreement within 90 days, force those agreements out of committee. They can't hold them up in committee. They're not allowed to amend anything in those agreements. They can't change a single period, comma, letter, or word. And then when the trade agreements actually go to be debated, they're only allowed 20 hours of debate. That doesn't mean 3 hours one day, 5 hours the next, 6 hours another day. It means once the debate starts, the clock is ticking. And after 20 hours, these agreements are not allowed to be debated anymore.
For folks wanting more information about your organization, is there a website you can direct them to?
Absolutely. People can find out more about our organization and our work at tradejustice.net. I am within tradejustice.net. Tradejustice.net is the website of Trade Justice New York Metro. Trade Justice New York Metro is a coalition of groups in the New York metropolitan area who are working to fight for fairer and more responsible trade policies. I work with an organization in Trade Justice New York Metro called Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, and our website is gjae.org. And I would also really urge our friends in Oregon to connect with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign and the important work that they are doing to take this message to Senator Wyden to let him know that Fast Track needs to be rejected. Oregon Fair Trade Campaign can be reached at their website, citizenstrade.org/CTC/Oregon, or you can call them at 503-736-9777. And we really just encourage Oregonians to get involved. Oregon is now, and actually an easier website for that organization is OregonFairTrade.org. Again, that's OregonFairTrade.org. Oregon right now is the most important state in the country for ensuring that our future trade agreements will not undermine democracy and will not undermine our laws, because there is no one more important in the country right now than Ron Wyden. So if you're an Oregonian and you're listening to this, we New Yorkers are counting on you to help save democracy. We need your help. So again, Oregon Fair Trade Campaign is 503-736-9777, and that's OregonFairTrade.org, and our organization is TradeJustice.net and GJAE.org.
Thanks again. I want to wish you a lovely weekend and let you get to it so I can get to editing this audio so it's ready in less than an hour.
You're welcome. Do I need to repeat any of that that I sort of garbled or...
Oh, no, you were lovely, perfect, and wonderful. If you're ever in town, you look me up. I know Elizabeth Swagger and Arthur Stimulus pretty darn well. We slay dragons together.
Nice.
So you have yourself a lovely weekend, and I will be in touch. Hopefully you'll let me call you again sometime soon.
Great, absolutely. And if you could send me a clip of the interview, I'd love to hear it.
If you've got a Facebook page, I'll make sure that the audio gets there.
Great. I do. It's you can just look for my name or otherwise just for our group, which is Trade Justice New York Metro.
Okay. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Take care.
Good night. I've been talking with Adam Weissman of Trade Justice. For more information, you can visit their website at tradejustice.net. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
As the fight against Fast Track heats up, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is feeling the pressure. Wyden had planned on having a fundraiser in Washington, D.C. Tuesday night. Originally, Wyden and the prospective donors were to have met at an expensive French restaurant. However, opponents of Fast Track got wind of the location of the fundraiser. Apparently, the threat of public scrutiny caused Wyden to cancel the event. Wyden claimed that the event was not canceled, but merely changed locations. On the other hand, his office insisted that they did not know where the fundraiser had taken place.
Airstrikes led by Saudi Arabia and supported by other members of the Gulf Cooperating Council and the U.S. government continued to hit Yemen today. Yemen is one of the world's most impoverished countries, and reports from the ground say that the situation is continuing to unravel. Reports indicate that a first wave of bombing overnight resulted in a number of civilian deaths, including entire families trapped in flattened houses. These events have spurred widespread anger in the capital Sana'a and other targeted cities. The anger has even spread to members of the population opposed to the Houthi rebels, who have now wrested control of much of the country from President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi. The president has escaped the country, and his whereabouts remain hard to estimate. The White House has said it is actively supporting the operation, and President Obama has authorized U.S. logistical and intelligence support for the bombing campaign. However, according to National Security Council spokeswoman, U.S. forces are not involved in direct military action in Yemen. The Houthi-controlled Ministry of Health said that at least 18 civilians were killed and 24 were injured during airstrikes that hit the capital city of Sana'a. According to Al Jazeera English, strikes were also reported in an area held by the Houthi rebels along the border with Saudi Arabia. A rally by Houthi supporters took place in the Sana'a on Thursday, with thousands of Yemeni citizens angrily condemning Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and other members of the coalition.
The multinational utility company Suez Environmental has pulled out of a cable car line project in Israel. The route would connect settlers in East Jerusalem to the western part of the city. Palestinian groups, including the Palestine Liberation Organization, praised the decision by Suez International to pull out of the project. In a statement made Wednesday, the company said that Suez Environment has decided not to take part in this project to avoid taking sides in a contentious political debate.
U.S. peace activist Tristan Anderson had his final court hearing yesterday in his civil case against the Israeli military. Anderson was severely wounded and disabled for life in 2009 when an Israeli soldier fired a tear gas canister directly at his face at close range. The canister hit Anderson in the forehead, splitting his head open and leading to the partial removal of his frontal lobe, blinding him in the right eye and paralyzing half of his body. Years later, Tristan continues to require around-the-clock care because of cognitive impairment and physical disability. Tristan's family filed a civil lawsuit against the state of Israel after the state failed to press criminal charges against the soldiers responsible. They waited for years to have their day in court, and now that the proceedings have concluded, may have to wait years for a ruling. According to Anderson's partner, Gabby Silverman, the court hearing on Thursday concluded the final civil proceedings of Tristan Anderson against the Israeli military, with testimony from Officer Yossi and Commander Sharon of the Border Police. This ends all court appearances in the case. Both sides will submit closing arguments in writing over the next several months, and sometime in the future, Judge Yaakobi will issue his ruling, also in writing. As soon as the court hearing ended, Silverman, who is Jewish, received a formal order that she must leave the state of Israel within the next 7 days. The reason stated on the paperwork included insufficient proof that there was a lawsuit going on and insufficient proof that she is a Jew.
Guest workers in luxury resorts in the Maldives, an archipelago south of India, are protesting the way they've been treated. The head of the Immigration and Economics Ministry criticized the protests, saying that the ministry would revoke work visas of those who participate. Somewhere between 50 and 200,000 foreign workers are employed in the Maldives. The Constitution says that anybody on Maldivian soil may peacefully protest. Complaints of the workers include theft of identification and travel credentials, wage theft, and debt conscription. The Four Seasons hotel chain operates two resorts in the island nation. Rooms at the Four Seasons in the Maldives start at $1,800 US a night, double occupancy. Earlier this month, the former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, was sentenced to 13 years in prison on so-called terrorism charges for firing a judge while he was president. Nasheed was forced out of office in 2012 in what he said was a military coup. Thousands of people took to the streets to protest the coup and were attacked by government forces. In February, the government had him arrested and found him guilty of ordering the arrest of a judge while in office. Those charges were dropped. He was then rearrested and charged under anti-terrorism laws.
There's a pretty decent chance that you have constant internet access, probably even broadband. That might make it difficult for you to imagine that an estimated 2 billion people globally have no internet access at all. Several companies aim to change that by covering the Earth with Wi-Fi beamed from satellites and balloons in space. However, a new global coalition wants to prevent this from happening. Andrew Geller has more on the story.
The Global Union Against Radiation Deployment from Space, or GARDS, doesn't oppose providing internet service to the billions without, just the method these companies propose, which is
taking a substance, radio frequency radiation, that has been classified by the pretty conservative World Health Organization as a class 2B carcinogen and inundating us all with it from space.
Ed Friedman is a spokesperson for GARDS. He points out that thousands of studies going back decades demonstrate serious biological harm caused by microwave radio frequency radiation, the signals which enable nearly all wireless communication devices. Despite this,
it seems very clear from the way wireless technologies have developed heavily in the last 10, 15 years that those developers are not considering or are not taking seriously threats to human and ecological health.
Beyond the radiation, Guards is concerned about the potential number of rocket launches needed to maintain the thousands of satellites to make these systems work. Hard numbers on this aren't readily available, but might be less important than imagined, since depending on the size and weight of these new satellites, they could piggyback on existing planned launches, which currently number 70 or 80 per year. Additional launches for these systems would likely have a negligible climate impact, according to Dr. Martin Ross, a senior scientist with the Aerospace Corporation, who notes that the civil aviation industry contributes far more greenhouse gases than rocketry. For decades, Dr. Ross has been a leading expert on the impact to stratospheric ozone from rocket launch emissions, something that has been well studied. He says that the impact from the end of these satellites' lives may be greater than at launch.
When they come down in an uncontrolled manner, which most of them do, they burn up and further add to the particle population in the stratosphere. We really don't have any idea how these particles affect the chemistry in the stratosphere. It's kind of like taking a bunch of computers and burning them, and you end up with a whole zoo of unusual particles that we don't know what their effects are. If they're saying that this fleet is several thousand satellites and they have a lifetime of 4 or 5 years, then we know that there will be 3 or 4 of these things coming in every day. They'll come in and melt and vaporize, and a shower of small particles will enter the stratosphere and accumulate from above, and we don't know what these unusual particles will do.
Multiple requests each to SpaceX and OneWeb, which in total may launch 5,000 satellites for space-based Wi-Fi, went unanswered. I'm Andrew Geller, KBOO News.